formation. He did not detail Oswald's offer to have a private negotiating channel or his suggestion that Britain cede Canada to America. Nor was Franklin fully candid with the Congress, which had instructed its peace commissioners, with Franklin's approval, not to do anything without France's full knowledge and support. In a letter in late June to Robert Livingston, the new American Foreign Secretary, Franklin reported that Britain had sent over two envoys, Oswald and Grenville, and he claimed that he had rejected their attempts to split America from France. They had at first some hopes of getting the belligerent powers to treat separately, one after another, but finding that impracticable, they have, after several messages sent to and fro, come to a resolution of treating with all together for a general peace. The very next day, however, he reiterated his desire for a separate channel in a letter he wrote for Oswald to give to Shelburne. "I cannot but hope that it is still intended to vest you with authority respecting the treaty with America." Britain was likewise engaging in back-channel intrigue. In addition to holding informal discussions with the French, it sent envoys directly to the Congress, trying to urge members to accept some form of dominion status for America that would permit separate parliaments loyal to a common king. When Franklin heard of these overtures, he wrote another letter to Livingston, warning that they must be forcefully resisted. "The king hates us most cordially," he declared. "If he were allowed any degree of power or government over America, it will soon be extended by corruption, artifice, and force until we are reduced to absolute subjection." Franklin's Peace Plan. At the beginning of July, the negotiating situation was simplified by the death of Lord Rockingham. Shelburne took over as Prime Minister, Fox resigned as Foreign Secretary, and Grenville was recalled. The time was right for Franklin to make an informal but precise peace offer to Oswald, which he did on July 10th. His proposal was divided into two parts: necessary provisions and advisable ones. Four fell into the former category. Independence for America that was full and complete in every sense, the removal of all British troops, secure boundaries, and fishing rights off the Canadian coast. In the advisable category were four suggested provisions: payment of reparations for the destruction in America, an acknowledgement of British guilt, a free trade agreement, and the ceding of Canada to the United States. Oswald immediately sent Shelburne all the details. But Franklin kept the proposals private and never recorded them. Nor did he consult with or even inform Vergennes about the offer he had made to Oswald. Thus, with clear vision and a bit of conniving, Franklin had set the stage for the final negotiations that would end the Revolutionary War. Shelburne promptly informed Oswald that the suggestions were unequivocal proofs of Dr. Franklin's sincerity. Britain was willing, he said, to affirm America's independence as a preliminary to negotiations, and it should be done decidedly so as to avoid future risks of enmity. If America would drop the advisable provisions, Shelburne said, and those called necessary alone retained as the ground of discussion, then he was confident that a treaty could be speedily concluded. Although it would take a few more months, that is, in essence, what happened. The final resolution was delayed, however, when Franklin was struck by cruel gout and kidney stones, which incapacitated him for much of August and September. John Jay, who had finally arrived in Paris, took over as the lead negotiator. The flinty New Yorker objected that the wording of Oswald's commission, which authorized him to negotiate with the said colonies and plantations, was not much better than Grenville's had been, and he demanded that Oswald get a clear statement that he was dealing with an independent nation before talks proceeded further. When Jay and Franklin went to call on Vergennes, the French minister advised that it did not seem necessary to insist that Oswald's commission contain a clear declaration of America's sovereignty. Franklin, who likewise gave his opinion that Oswald's commission would do, was thrilled by Vergennes' tacit approval for the British-American negotiations to proceed, which he interpreted as a magnanimous and supportive gesture showing France's gracious goodwill. Jay's interpretation, more sinister but more correct, was that Vergennes did not want Britain to recognize American independence except as part of a comprehensive peace settlement involving France and Spain. "This court chooses to postpone an acknowledgment of our independence by Britain," Jay reported to the Congress, "in order to keep us under their direction until all the demands of France and Spain were met. I ought to add that Dr. Franklin does not see the conduct of this court in the light I do." Jay's skepticism about France's motives led to a heated argument with Franklin when they returned to Passy from Versailles that evening. Jay was especially angry, he told Franklin, that Vergennes had brought up Spain's desire to claim some of the land between the Allegheny Mountains and the Mississippi River. Franklin fully agreed that Spain should not be permitted to coop us up, but he gave Jay one of his gentle lectures about the wisdom of assuming that a friend like France was acting in good faith until there was hard evidence to the contrary. France was not trying to hold up negotiations, as Jay kept angrily insisting. Instead, Franklin argued, Vergennes had shown a willingness to speed them along by not objecting to the wording of Oswald's commission. But Jay's suspicions were reinforced when he learned that Vergennes had sent a deputy on a secret mission to London. Trusting neither the French nor Franklin, Jay joined in the back-channel fandango by dispatching a secret envoy of his own to London. What made this especially intriguing was that the man he sent was Benjamin Vaughan, Franklin's longtime friend and publisher, who had come to Paris to visit Franklin and do what he could to promote peace. Jay asked Vaughan to tell Lord Shelburne that Oswald's commission needed to state unambiguously that he was to negotiate with the United States. Such an explicit acknowledgment of American independence at the outset, Jay promised, would help cut the cords that bound America to France. Shelburne, eager to conclude a peace before his government toppled, was willing to go far enough to satisfy Jay. In mid-September, his cabinet granted Oswald a new commission to treat with the commissioners appointed by the colonies under the title of 13 United States, and it reaffirmed that American independence could be acknowledged as a preliminary to further discussions. So on October 5th, with Jay and Franklin both satisfied and back in harmony, official negotiations began. Oswald presented his formal new commission, and Jay presented a proposed treaty that was very similar to the one Franklin had informally offered in July. The only addition to Franklin's four necessary points was a provision that was sure to please Britain, though not France or Spain, that both Britain and America would have free navigation rights on the Mississippi. Their momentum, however, was slowed for a few weeks after Britain succeeded in beating back a French-Spanish attack on Gibraltar, thus emboldening their ministers. To stiffen Oswald's backbone, Shelburne sent over Henry Strachey, a cabinet officer who had served as Admiral Howe's secretary. Just as he arrived, so did John Adams yet again, to assume his role as a member of the American delegation. Adams was as blunt as ever, filled with suspicions and doubting everyone's character but his own. Even Lafayette, who had become Franklin's close confidant, was immediately slammed by Adams as a mongrel character of unlimited ambition who was panting for glory. Adams also displayed in a public and undiplomatic way his personal distrust of Vergennes by not calling on him for almost 3 weeks, until the minister caused him to be reminded of his duty to do so. Vergennes, who was as smooth as Adams was rough, baffled the wary Adams by laying on a lavish dinner and plying him with fine wines and Madeira. Adams likewise initially balked at paying a courtesy call on Franklin, who was pretty much confined to Passy with the gout and kidney stones, even though they had managed to exchange civil letters during Adams's mission in Holland. "He could not bear to go near him," Matthew Ridley, an American merchant in Paris, recorded in his diary. Ridley, who was a friend of both men, finally convinced Adams that it was necessary. Adams felt particularly spiteful because he had recently learned about the letter Franklin had written to the Congress at the behest of Vergennes, which had led to his earlier recall. "Franklin had been motivated by base jealousy and sordid envy," Adams told a friend. That was a complete misreading of Franklin, who had acted more out of annoyance than jealousy, and whose occasional vices did not include an excess of envy. Whatever the cause, Adams was filled with anger by the time he arrived back in Paris. "That I have no friendship for Franklin, I avow," he wrote. "That I am incapable of having any with a man of his moral sentiments, I avow." In his diary, Adams had even more to say. "Franklin's cunning will be to divide us. To this end he will provoke, he will insinuate, he will intrigue, he will maneuver." So it was a great testament to Franklin's charm that, as it turned out, he got along rather well with Adams once they settled down to work. When Adams bluntly told him during the visit he finally made to Passy that he agreed with Jay's tougher attitude toward France, "The doctor heard me patiently but said nothing." And at a meeting of the three commissioners the next day, Franklin serenely agreed with Adams and Jay that it made sense to meet with the British negotiators without coordinating with the French. Turning to Jay, he said, "I am of your opinion and will go on with these gentlemen in the business without consulting this court." Franklin's willingness to negotiate without consulting France was not new. He had begun pursuing that approach before Jay and Adams arrived in Paris. But he made it seem that he was doing it partly in deference to the views of his two fellow commissioners, which served to soften Adams's attitude. "Franklin has gone on with us in entire harmony and unanimity," Adams happily recorded in his diary, "and has been able and useful, both by his sagacity and his reputation, in the whole negotiation." For his part, Franklin continued to feel the same mixture of admiration and annoyance toward Adams that he had long held. As he would put it to Livingston a few months later, once the negotiations were over, "He means well for his country, is always an honest man, often a wise one, but sometimes and in some things absolutely out of his senses." On October 30th, Adams's 47th birthday, the American negotiators and their British counterparts launched an intense week of negotiations, which started at 11 each morning and continued through late suppers most evenings. The British readily accepted the four necessary points that Franklin had proposed back in July, but not the advisable points, such as the ceding of Canada. The main disputes they faced that week were 1. Fishing rights off Newfoundland. This was a major issue for Adams, who, as David McCullough points out, was eloquent in his sermons on New England's ancient stake in the sacred codfish. Franklin was likewise firm on the point, and he provided an economic argument. The money that Americans made from fishing would be spent on British manufactures once friendship was restored. "Are you afraid there is not fish enough?" he asked, "or that we should catch too many?" The British conceded the point to the dismay of France, which was hoping to win special fishing rights of its own. When Franklin was accused by his enemies in America of favoring the French position and opposing a demand for American fishing rights, he wrote Jay and Adams asking them to attest to his firmness. Jay graciously complied, and Adams did so more grudgingly. 2. Pre-war debts still owed by Americans to British merchants. Franklin and Jay felt they should be renounced, because Britain had taken or destroyed so much American property. Adams, however, insisted that such debts be honored, and his view prevailed. 3. The Western Boundary. With his lifelong vision of American expansion, Franklin insisted that no other nation should have rights to the land between the Alleghenies and the Mississippi. As Jay recorded, "He has invariably declared it to be his opinion that we should insist on the Mississippi as our western boundary." Again, this is not something that France or Spain would have supported at a general peace conference. But Britain was happy to accept the river as the western boundary, along with free navigation rights for both nations. 4. Compensation for the British loyalists in America whose estates had been confiscated. This was the most contentious issue, and Franklin made it even more so. He justified his implacable stance on moral grounds. The loyalists had helped cause the war, and their losses were far less than those suffered by American patriots whose property had been destroyed by the British. But his stubbornness also had a personal component. Among the most visible loyalists were his former friend Joseph Galloway, and, more notably, his estranged son William. Franklin's anger toward his son, and his desire to prove it publicly, had a major impact on his attitude toward the Loyalist claims, and it added a painful personal poignancy to the final weeks of negotiations. William, who had been released from his Connecticut captivity through a prisoner exchange in September 1778, had been living in British-occupied New York, where he served as the president of the Board of Associated Loyalists. In that capacity, he had encouraged a series of small but brutal raids on American forces. One of these resulted in the lynching murder of an American captain, and General Washington had responded by threatening to hang one of his British prisoners a young and very well-connected officer named Charles Asgill, if the perpetrators were not brought to justice. Asgill's friends and family used their great influence to try to save his life, and Shelburne sent a personal appeal to Franklin to intercede. Franklin sharply refused. Washington's aim was to obtain the punishment of a deliberate murderer, he replied. If the English refuse to deliver up or punish this murderer, it is saying that they choose to preserve him rather than Captain Asgill. It seems to me, therefore, that the application should be made to the English ministers. The issue became more personal for Franklin when a British court-martial acquitted the accused British soldier on the grounds that he was merely following orders. That prompted outraged Americans to demand the arrest of the person who had issued those orders, William Franklin. So, in August 1782, 20 years after his arrival in America as New Jersey governor, William prudently fled back to London, where he arrived in late September, just as his father's final round of peace negotiations with Oswald was beginning. The meddlesome Vaughan further complicated matters by urging Shelburne to be solicitous toward William. He informed the Prime Minister that Temple Franklin had, when Vaughan discussed it with him in Passy, intimated hopes to see something done for his father. And Vaughan later added his own belief, very mistaken, that doing so would have a seasonable effect on Benjamin Franklin's disposition toward Britain. So Shelburne met with William and promised to do all he could to help both him and the Loyalists. Franklin was chagrined when he learned of all this, and was especially angry when he discovered that Vaughan's misguided interference had come at the behest of young Temple, who had interceded on his father's behalf without telling his grandfather. Franklin expressed his sentiments, as he often did, in a short fable. There was once, he wrote, a great lion, king of the forest, who had among his subjects a body of faithful dogs. But the lion king, influenced by evil counselors, went to war with them. The few of them of a mongrel race, derived from a mixture of wolves and foxes, corrupted by royal promises of great rewards, deserted the honest dogs and joined their enemies. When the dogs won their freedom, the wolves and foxes of the king's council gathered to argue for compensation to the mongrels who had remained loyal. But a horse arose, with a boldness and freedom that became the nobleness of his nature, and argued that any reward for fratricide was unjust, and would lead only to further wars. The council had sense enough, Franklin concluded, to resolve that the demand be rejected. In the final days of the negotiations, Franklin became even more obdurate against any compensation for the Loyalists, even as Adams and Jay showed some willingness to compromise on the issue. In the past, Adams had accused Franklin of being untrustworthy because of his supposed sympathy toward his Loyalist son. Now he was baffled that Franklin was being so belligerent in the other direction. "Dr. Franklin is very staunch against the Tories," he noted in his diary, "more decided on this point than Mr. Jay or myself." Given the influence of the Loyalist emigrants now living in Britain, Shelburne knew that his ministry might fall if he did nothing to satisfy their claims. His negotiators pushed until the very last day, but Franklin threatened to scuttle the entire treaty over this point. He pulled from his pocket a paper that resurrected his own demand that Britain, if it wanted any recompense for the Loyalists' estates, must pay for all of the American towns destroyed, goods taken, cargo captured, villages burned, and even his own looted library in Philadelphia. The British were forced to relent. After hearing Franklin's diatribe, they retired to an adjacent room, huddled, and returned to say they would accept instead a somewhat meaningless promise that the Congress would earnestly recommend to the individual states that they make whatever restitution each of them saw fit for the Loyalists' estates confiscated there. The Americans knew that the states would end up doing little, so they agreed. But Franklin still insisted on one caveat, aimed at William. The recommendation would not apply to Loyalists who had borne arms against the said United States. The next morning, November 30th, 1782, the American negotiators, along with their secretary, Temple Franklin, met with the British in Oswald's suite at the Grand Hotel Muscovite to sign the provisional treaty that, in effect, ended the Revolutionary War. In a nod to the obligations owed France, the pact would not become formally binding until terms of a peace shall be agreed upon between Great Britain and France. That would take another 9 months. But the treaty had an immediate and irrevocable import that was contained in its opening line, which declared the United States to be free, sovereign, and independent. That afternoon, the American negotiators all went to Passy, where Franklin hosted a celebratory dinner. Even John Adams was feeling mellower, at least for the time being. He conceded to his friend Matthew Ridley that Franklin had behaved well and nobly. Placating the French. To Franklin fell the difficult duty of explaining to Vergennes why the Americans had breached their obligations to France and their instructions from the Congress by agreeing to a treaty without consulting him. After sending Vergennes a copy of the signed accord, which he stressed was provisional, Franklin called on him at Versailles the following week. The French minister remarked, coolly but politely, that proceeding in this abrupt signature of the articles was not agreeable to the French king, and that the Americans had not been particularly civil. Nevertheless, Vergennes did allow that the Americans had done well by themselves, and he noted that our conversation was amicable. Only when Franklin followed up with a brash request for yet another French loan, along with the information that he was transmitting the peace accord to the Congress, did Vergennes take the opportunity to protest officially. It was lacking in propriety, he wrote Franklin, for him to hold out a certain hope of peace to America without even informing yourself on the state of negotiation on our part. America was under an obligation not to consider ratifying any peace until France had also come to terms with Britain. You have all your life performed your duties, Vergennes continued. I pray you to consider how you propose to fulfill those which are due to the king. Franklin's response, which has been called a diplomatic masterpiece and one of the most famous of all diplomatic letters, combined a few dignified expressions of contrition with appeals to France's national interest. Nothing has been agreed in the preliminaries contrary to the interests of France, he noted, not entirely correctly, and no peace is to take place between us and England until you have concluded yours. Using a French word that roughly translates as propriety, Franklin sought to minimize the American transgression. in not consulting you before they were signed, we have been guilty of neglecting a point of bienséance. But as this was not from want of respect for the king, whom we all love and honor, we hope it will be excused, and that the great work, which has hitherto been so happily conducted, is so nearly brought to perfection, and is so glorious to his reign, will not be ruined by a single indiscretion of ours." He went on, undaunted, to press his case for another loan. "Certainly this whole edifice sinks to the ground immediately, if you refuse on that account to give us any further assistance." With that came both a plea and an implied threat. Making a public issue of the transgression, he warned, could hurt the mutual interests of both countries. "The English, I just now learn, flatter themselves they have already divided us. I hope this little misunderstanding will therefore be kept a secret, and that they will find themselves totally mistaken." Vergennes was stunned by Franklin's letter, a copy of which he sent to his ambassador in Philadelphia. "You may imagine my astonishment," he wrote. "I think it proper that the most influential members of Congress should be informed of the very irregular conduct of their commissioners in regard to us." He did not blame Franklin personally, except to say that he has yielded too easily to the bias of his colleagues. Vergennes went on to lament, correctly, that the new nation was not one that would enter into entangling alliances. "We shall be but poorly paid for all that we have done for the United States," he complained, "and for securing to them a national existence." There was little Vergennes could do. Forcing a showdown, as Franklin had subtly warned, would drive the Americans into an even faster and closer alliance with Britain. So, reluctantly, he let the matter drop, instructed his envoy not to file an official protest with the Congress, and even agreed to supply yet another French loan. Two great diplomatic duelists had formally crossed swords, Karl Van Doren noted, and the philosopher had exquisitely disarmed the minister. Yes, but perhaps a better analogy would be to Franklin's own favorite game of chess. From his opening gambit that led to America's treaty of alliance with France, to the end game that produced a peace with England while preserving French friendship, Franklin mastered a three-dimensional game against two aggressive players by exhibiting great patience when the pieces were not properly aligned, and carefully exploiting strategic advantages when they were. Franklin had been instrumental in shaping the three great documents of the war: the Declaration of Independence, the alliance with France, and the treaty with England. Now he turned his thoughts to peace. "All wars are follies, very expensive and very mischievous ones," he wrote Polly Stevenson. "When will mankind be convinced of this, and agree to settle their differences by arbitration? Were they to do it, even by the cast of a die, it would be better than by fighting and destroying each other." To Joseph Banks, one of the many old friends from England, he wrote in celebration. He asserted yet again his famous, albeit somewhat misleading, credo. "There never was a good war or a bad peace." Benny and Temple. Rather than return home immediately, Franklin decided to relish his newly earned peace and leisure by enjoying the friends, family, and intellectual pursuits available to him in the idyllic setting of Passy. His grandson, Benny, had been languishing at his school in Geneva, which had recently been thrown into political turmoil over plans to give full voting rights to all citizens. Now that his diplomatic duties had subsided, Franklin decided to permit Benny to come back to Passy for a vacation during the summer of 1783, his first since leaving 4 years earlier. Reunited at last with the grandfather he was so eager to impress, Benny was completely charmed. Franklin was very different from other old persons, he told a visitor, for they are fretful and complaining and dissatisfied, and my grandpapa is laughing and cheerful like a young person. Their new proximity also warmed Franklin. Benny was so well grown, he wrote the boy's parents, and so much improved in his learning and behavior. To Polly Stevenson, he wrote, "He gains every day upon my affections." That summer, during which Benny turned 14, his grandfather took him to the Seine for swimming lessons, and his cousin Temple taught him fencing and dancing. Temple also impressed him by pretending to kill a mouse with helium, then reviving him, then killing him for good with an electric spark from one of Franklin's batteries. "I am sure my cousin would pass for a conjurer in America," Benny wrote his parents. Benny had been sickly and depressed at school, Franklin learned, and the political situation in Geneva remained volatile. So he decided that the boy need not return, even though he had left his clothes and books there. He had earlier considered sending Benny to school in England under the care of Polly Stevenson, who had been excited by the prospect. Now, worried that Benny was losing his command of English, he raised the possibility with Polly more seriously. "Would that still be convenient to you?" he asked. "He is docile and of gentle manners, ready to receive and follow good advice, and will set no bad example to your other children." Polly was wary but willing. "I fear he will think us so unpolished he will scarcely be able to endure us," she replied. "But if English cordiality will make amends for French refinement, we may have some chance of making him happy." Franklin, who had grown ever more fond of Benny, instead decided that he should stay in Passy. "He showed such an unwillingness to leave me, and Temple such a fondness for retaining him, that I concluded to keep him," Franklin explained to Polly in a letter at the end of 1783. "He behaves very well, and we love him very much." Perhaps with his felicity in language, Benny could become a diplomat, Franklin thought. That would require, however, getting him a public appointment, something that was proving difficult for Temple. He had once told Richard Bache, just as he had told his son William and many others, that it was demeaning to be dependent on a government appointment. Now he expressed the same sentiment to Richard again, this time in a letter about his son Benny. "I have determined to give him a trade, that he may have something to depend on, and not be obliged to ask favors or offices of anybody." The trade Franklin chose was the obvious one. His private little printing press at Passy was busy that autumn turning out editions of his bagatelles, so he was delighted when the boy eagerly started to work there. A master founder was hired to teach him how to cast type, and by spring Franklin had persuaded François Didot, the greatest and most artistic printer in France, to take him on as a student. Benny was destined to follow in Franklin's footsteps, not only as a printer but also eventually as a newspaper editor. As for Temple, Franklin was reduced to asking for favors and offices. As he was enjoying the sweet summer of 1783, he wrote to Foreign Secretary Livingston yet another plaintive plea on poor Temple's behalf. He has now gone through an apprenticeship of near 7 years in the ministerial business, and is very capable of serving the states in that line, as possessing all the requisites of knowledge, zeal, activity, language, and address. But it is not my custom to solicit employments for myself or any of my family, and I shall not do it in this case. I only hope that, if he is not to be employed in your new arrangement, I may be informed of it as soon as possible, that, while I have strength left for it, I may accompany him in a tour to Italy, returning through Germany, which I think he may make to more advantage with me than alone, and which I have long promised to afford him as a reward for his faithful service and his tender filial attachment to me. Temple did not get a ministerial posting, nor did his grandfather take him on a grand tour. Instead, he emulated his grandfather and father in a less laudable way than Benny. After failing to marry either one of the Brion's daughters, Temple became involved with a married woman who lived near Passy, Blanchette Caillot, whose husband was a successful actor. With her, he fathered an illegitimate son, Theodore. In a cruel irony, the child died from smallpox, the disease that had taken the only legitimate son among 3 generations of Franklins. Theodore Franklin, the illegitimate son of the illegitimate son of Franklin's own illegitimate son, was, albeit briefly, the last male-line descendant of Benjamin Franklin, who would in the end leave no family line bearing his name. Balloon Mania. Among the diversions Benny enjoyed with his grandfather in the summer and fall of 1783 were the grand spectacles of the first balloon flights. The age of air travel began in June, when 2 brothers, Joseph and Étienne Montgolfier, launched an unmanned hot air balloon near Lyon that rose to a height of 6,000 feet. The Franklins were not there, but they did witness in late August the first unmanned flight using hydrogen. A scientist named Jacques Charles launched a 12-foot diameter silk balloon filled with hydrogen produced by pouring oil of vitriol over fiery iron filings. With great fanfare, it took off from Paris in front of 50,000 spectators and floated for more than 45 minutes before landing in a village more than 15 miles away. "The country people who saw it fall were frightened," Franklin wrote Sir Joseph Banks, president of the Royal Society, "and attacked it with stones and knives so that it was much mangled." The race was then on to produce the first manned flight, and it was won on November 21st by the Montgolfiers with their hot air model. As a huge crowd cheered and countless women fainted, the balloon took off with 2 champagne-toting noblemen who initially found themselves snared by some tree branches. "I was then in great pain for the men, thinking them in danger of being thrown out or burnt," Franklin reported. But soon they were free and gliding their way over the Seine, and after 20 minutes they landed on the other side and popped their corks in triumph. Franklin was among the distinguished scientists who signed the official certification of the historic flight the following evening, when the Montgolfiers called on him at Passy. The Montgolfiers believed that the lift was caused not just by hot air but also by smoke, so they instructed their aeronauts to ply the fire with wet straw and wool. Franklin, however, was more partial to Charles' inflammable air model using hydrogen, and he helped to finance the first manned flight in such a balloon. It took place 10 days later. As Franklin watched from his carriage parked near the Tuileries Gardens, his gout preventing him from joining the throng on the wet grass, Charles and a partner flew for more than 2 hours and landed safely 27 miles away. Once again, Franklin provided a report to the Royal Society through Banks. "I had a pocket glass with which I followed it until I lost sight first of the men, then of the car, and when I last saw the balloon it appeared no bigger than a walnut." Ever since the days of his electricity experiments, Franklin believed that science should be pursued initially for pure fascination and curiosity, and then practical uses would eventually flow from what was discovered. At first he was reluctant to guess what practical use might come of balloons, but he was convinced that experimenting with them would someday, as he told Banks, pave the way to some discoveries in natural philosophy of which at present we have no conception. There could be, he noted in another letter, important consequences that no one can foresee. More famous was his pithier expression of the same sentiment, made in response to a spectator who asked what use this new balloon thing could be. "What is the use," he replied, "of a newborn baby?" Because the English saw no utility in ballooning, and because they were a bit too proud to follow the French, they did not join in the excitement. I see an inclination in the more respectable part of the Royal Society to guard against the ballomania until some experiment likely to prove beneficial either to society or science is proposed, Banks wrote. Franklin scoffed at this attitude. "It does not seem to me a good reason to decline prosecuting a new experiment which apparently increases the power of man over matter until we can see to what use that power may be applied," he replied. "When we have learned to manage it, we may hope some time or other to find uses for it, as men have done for magnetism and electricity, of which the first experiments were mere matters of amusement." By early the following year, he had come up with one possibility for a practical use. Balloons might serve as a way to wage war, or, even better, as a way to preserve peace. "Convincing sovereigns of the folly of wars may perhaps be one effect, since it will be impracticable for the most potent of them to guard his dominions," he wrote to his friend Jan Ingenhuis, the Dutch scientist and physician. Mainly, however, Franklin contented himself with enjoying the craze and all the entertainments surrounding it. Exhibition flights of fanciful balloons decorated and gilded in glorious patterns became the rage in Paris that season, and they even influenced hats and hairstyles, fashions, and dances. Temple Franklin and Benny Bache produced their own miniature models, and Franklin wrote one of his typical parodies, which, like many of his early ones, used the anonymous voice of a fictional woman. "If you want to fill your balloons with an element 10 times lighter than inflammable air," she wrote to one of the newspapers, "you can find a great quantity of it and ready-made in the promises of lovers and of courtiers." Éminence Grise. Even as he indulged in the frivolities of pre-revolutionary Paris, Franklin focused much of his writing on his egalitarian, anti-elitist ideas for building a new American society based on middle-class virtues. His daughter, Sally, sent him newspaper clippings about the formation of a hereditary order of merit called the Society of the Cincinnati, which was headed by General Washington and open to distinguished officers of the American Army who would pass the title down to their eldest sons. Franklin, replying at the beginning of 1784, ridiculed the concept. "The Chinese were right," he said, "to honor the parents of people who earned distinction, for they had some role in it. But honoring a worthy person's descendants, who had nothing to do with achieving the merit, is not only groundless and absurd, but often hurtful to that posterity. Any form of hereditary aristocracy or nobility was," he declared, "in direct opposition to the solemnly declared sense of their country." He also, in the letter, ridiculed the symbol of the new Cincinnati order, a bald eagle, which had also been selected as a national symbol. That provoked one of Franklin's most famous rifts about America's values and the question of a national bird. "I wish the bald eagle had not been chosen as the representative of our country. He is a bird of bad moral character. He does not get his living honestly. You may have seen him perched on some dead tree near the river where, too lazy to fish for himself, he watches the labors of the fishing hawk. The turkey is, in comparison, a much more respectable bird and a true original native of America. He is, though a little vain and silly, it is true, but not the worse emblem for that, a bird of courage, and would not hesitate to attack a grenadier of the British Guards." Franklin heard so frequently from people who wanted to emigrate to America that in early 1784 he printed a pamphlet in French and English designed to encourage the more industrious of them while discouraging those who sought a life of upper-class leisure. His essay, "Information to Those Who Would Remove to America," is one of the clearest expressions of his belief that American society should be based on the virtues of the middle, or mediocre, as he sometimes called them, meaning it as a word of praise, classes, of which he still considered himself a part. There were few people in America either as poor or as rich as those in Europe, he said. "It is rather a general happy mediocrity that prevails. Instead of rich proprietors and struggling tenants, most people cultivate their own lands or follow some craft or trade." Franklin was particularly harsh on those who sought hereditary privilege or who had no other quality to recommend him but his birth. "In America," he said, "people do not inquire of a stranger, 'What is he?' but 'What can he do?'" Reflecting his own pride in discovering that he had hard-working forebears rather than aristocratic ones, he said that a true American would think himself more obliged to a genealogist who could prove for him that his ancestors and relations for 10 generations had been plowmen, smiths, carpenters, turners, weavers, tanners, or even shoemakers, and consequently that they were useful members of society, than if he could only prove that they were gentlemen, doing nothing of value but living idly on the labor of others. America was creating a society, Franklin proclaimed, where a mere man of quality, who does not want to work, would be despised and disregarded, while anyone who has a useful skill would be honored. All of this made for a better moral clime. "The almost general mediocrity of fortune that prevails in America, obliging its people to follow some business for subsistence, those vices that arise usually from idleness, are in a great measure prevented," he concluded. "Industry and constant employment are great preservatives of morals and virtue." He purported to be describing the way America was, but he was also subtly prescribing what he wanted it to become. All in all, it was his best paean to the middle-class values he represented and helped to make integral to the new nation's character. Franklin's affection for the middle class and its virtues of hard work and frugality meant that his social theories tended to be a blend of conservatism, as we have seen, he was dubious of generous welfare laws that led to dependency among the poor, and populism. He was opposed to the privileges of inheritance and to wealth idly gained through ownership of large estates. In 1784, he expanded on these ideas by questioning the morality of excess personal luxuries. "I have not," he lamented to Benjamin Vaughan, "thought of a remedy for luxury." On the one hand, the desire for luxury spurred people to work hard. He recalled how his wife had once given a fancy hat to a country girl, and soon all the other girls in the village were working hard spinning mittens in order to earn money to buy fancy hats. This appealed to his utilitarian sentiments. Not only the girls were made happier by having fine caps, but the Philadelphians by the supply of warm mittens. However, too much time spent seeking luxuries was wasteful and a public evil. So he suggested that America should impose heavy duties on the importation of frivolous fineries. His antipathy to excess wealth also led him to defend high taxes, especially on luxuries. A person had a natural right to all he earned that was necessary to support himself and his family, he wrote Finance Minister Robert Morris. But all property superfluous to such purposes is the property of the public, who, by their laws, have created it. Likewise, to Vaughan, he argued that cruel criminal laws had been wrought by those who sought to protect excess ownership of property. "Superfluous property is the creature of society," he said. "Simple and mild laws were sufficient to guard the property that was merely necessary." To some of his contemporaries, both rich and poor, Franklin's social philosophy seemed an odd mix of conservative and radical beliefs. In fact, however, it formed a very coherent leather apron outlook. Unlike many subsequent revolutions, the American was not a radical rebellion by an oppressed proletariat. Instead, it was led largely by propertied and shopkeeping citizens, whose rather bourgeois rallying cry was, "No taxation without representation." Franklin's blend of beliefs would become part of the outlook of much of America's middle class. Its faith in the virtues of hard work and frugality, its benevolent belief in voluntary associations to help others, its conservative opposition to handouts that led to laziness and dependency, and its slightly ambivalent resentment of unnecessary luxury, hereditary privileges, and an idle, landowning leisure class. The end of the war permitted the resumption of amiable correspondence with old friends in England, most notably his fellow printer William Strawn, to whom he had written the famous but unsent letter 9 years earlier, declaring, "You are now my enemy." By 1780, he had mellowed enough to draft a letter signed, "Your formerly affectionate friend," which he then changed to, "Your long affectionate humble servant." By 1784, he was signing himself, "Most affectionately." Once again, they debated Franklin's theories that top government officials should serve without pay, and that England's society and government were inherently corrupt. Now, however, the tone was bantering, as Franklin suggested that the Americans, who have some remains of affection for the British, perhaps should help govern them. "If you have not sense and virtue enough left to govern yourselves," he wrote, "dissolve your present old crazy constitution and send members to Congress." Lest Strawn not realize he was joking, Franklin confessed, "You will say my advice smells of Madeira. You are right. This foolish letter is mere chit-chat between ourselves over the second bottle." Franklin also spent the early summer of 1784 adding more to his memoirs. He had written about 40% of what would become his famous autobiography at Bishop Shipley's in Twyford in 1771. Now he responded to a request from Vaughan, who said that Franklin's story would help to explain the manners of a rising people, and in Passy wrote what would become another 10% of that work. His focus at the time was on the need to build a new American character, and most of the section he wrote in 1784 was devoted to an explanation of the famous self-improvement project in which he sought to train himself in the 13 virtues, ranging from frugality and industry to temperance and humility. His Passy friends were especially thrilled by the tale of the slate booklet Franklin used to record his efforts at acquiring these virtues. Franklin, who still had not fully acquired all aspects of humility, proudly showed off the tablets to Cabanis, the young physician who lived with Madame Helvétius. "We touched this precious booklet," Cabanis exulted in his journal. "We held it in our hands. Here was, in a way, the chronological story of Franklin's soul." In his spare time, Franklin perfected one of his most famous and useful inventions, bifocal glasses. Writing to a friend in August 1784, he announced himself happy in the invention of double spectacles, which, serving for distant objects as well as near ones, make my eyes as useful to me as ever they were. A few months later, in response to a request for more information about your invention, Franklin provided details. "The same convexity of glass through which a man sees clearest and best at the distance proper for reading is not the best for greater distances. I therefore had formerly two pairs of spectacles, which I shifted occasionally, as in traveling I sometimes read and often wanted to regard the prospects. Finding this change troublesome and not always sufficiently ready, I had the glasses cut and half of each kind associated in the same circle. By this means, as I wear my glasses constantly, I have only to move my eyes up or down as I want to see distinctly far or near, the proper glasses being always ready." A portrait by Charles Wilson Peale, done in 1785, shows him wearing his new spectacles. Because of his renown both as a scientist and a rationalist, Franklin was appointed by the king in 1784 to a commission to investigate the theories of Friedrich Anton Mesmer, whose advocacy of a new method of healing led to the new word mesmerize. Another member of Franklin's commission, Dr. Joseph Ignace Guillotin, would also have his name turned into a neologism during the French Revolution. A flamboyant healer from Vienna, Mesmer believed that maladies were caused by the artificial disruption of a universal fluid emitted by heavenly bodies, and they could be cured by the techniques of animal magnetism he had discovered. His treatment involved putting patients around huge oak tubs filled with glass and iron filings, while a healer, carrying an iron wand, magnetized and mesmerized them. In a sign that the Enlightenment was losing its grip, mesmerism became wildly popular in Paris, replacing ballooning as the fad of the moment, with adherents that included Lafayette, Temple Franklin, and Queen Marie Antoinette. Many of the Commission's meetings were held in Passy, where Franklin himself, in the name of science, submitted to the treatments. In his diary, 14-year-old Benny recorded one session where Mesmer's disciples, after having magnetized many sick persons, are gone into the garden to magnetize some trees. It was clear that the power of suggestion could produce some strange effects. The commissioners, however, decided that our role was to keep cool, rational, and open-minded. So they blindfolded the patients, not letting them know whether or not they were being treated by Mesmer's doctors. We discovered we could influence them ourselves, so their answers were the same whether they had been magnetized or not. They concluded that Mesmer was a fraud, and what was at work was, as they put it in their report, the power of imagination. An unpublished annex to the report did note that the treatment was powerful at sexually stimulating young women when titillations délicieuses were applied. Franklin wrote to Temple, who was no longer a disciple of Mesmer, that the report had roundly debunked the theories. "Some think it will put an end to mesmerism," he added, "but there is a wonderful deal of credulity in the world, and deceptions as absurd have supported themselves for ages." Finale. One source of despair for Franklin was that in negotiating treaties with other European nations, he had to work with John Adams again. He was worried, he told one friend, about what will be the offspring of a coalition between my ignorance and his positiveness. Adams's brief period of mellowness had lasted for only a few months after the signing of the provisional peace with Britain, and he subsequently resumed his backbiting. "Franklin was an unintelligible politician," Adams wrote Robert Livingston. "If this gentleman and the marble mercury in the Garden of Versailles were in nomination for an embassy, I would not hesitate to give my vote for the statue, upon the principle that it would do no harm." So Franklin